I've got a wonderful little paragraph in Volcker's Changing Fortunes where he talks about you. He says that he had brought you in as an academic. Is that right? Were you a professor before you joined the Treasury?
Rice University in Houston, Texas. I was probably, I don't know, an associate professor down there or something when I came up to Treasury as a consultant.
What years were you at Rice?
That would be 1952, probably. The first academic year down there, if memory serves me correctly, and I went up to Treasury, about 10 years, because I went up to Treasury in July of 63, and was on a sabbatical for one semester at least.
Okay, this is neither here nor there, but I spent my freshman year at Rice University, 1962-1963, and then I transferred to the University of Chicago. The day I got there, August of 62, it had been over 100 degrees for 37 days in a row. That's one of my big memories of Rice. It was a very pleasant place. I liked it, but I was looking for somewhat different environments. So
certainly wasn't forever, when that's right.
Well, it was wasn't integrated then, and it was primarily a technical. Well, the really good students were the scientists and the engineers, and at that time I thought I was interested in history, and
so, sure.
But it was a good it was a good year. So you went into the Treasury in fall of 63.
July.
And so, Volcker, how were you recruited? He was involved in it?
I had written a piece for Fortune magazine. I don't know just when, probably 63, late 62, early 63. And I think it came to Rose's attention. He was the undersecretary, and he probably got in touch with Volcker and said, "Who is this guy down in Texas, writing about exchange markets?" And let's see, I think maybe David Meiselman, subsequently a very good friend, got in touch with me probably at an American Economics Association meeting, and I don't know, then Volcker appeared on the scene, maybe flew up from Philadelphia or something, and as an outgrowth, I went on down to Treasury and interviewed, and went back down to Rice, and subsequent correspondence, and so then I decided to come up to Treasury as a consultant, and did so in mid-63.
And so they hired you as a expert on balance of payments issues?
Foreign exchange, yes.
And so were you involved in the various programs to deal with balance of payments, the specific programs, Buy American, then the interest equalization tax, and the various forms of degrees of capital controls and so on? Did you get involved in those specific programs?
Not in the program, certainly not in their execution. When I went up to Treasury, the interest equalization tax, memory's faulty, but I think it may have been set up to the Hill probably that same summer. I think maybe around mid-63, and so I got involved in a menial sort of fashion, helping Volcker right at the very outset of my arrival at Treasury.
Did you notice a change in the Treasury when Fowler replaced Dillon? Was there a difference as far as you were concerned?
Not really. More continuity impressed me at the time.
In terms of balance of payments, the view was that the current account, well, I guess the deficit was primarily structural, and it did seem like it would pass in time as European capital markets develop. That seems still seems pretty reasonable. The change came when the inflation rate picked up in end of 65 and 66, and the U.S. began inflating faster than its partners. Does that sound right to you?
Sure. I don't mean to sound critical in sort of broad brush terms. I guess one could say the same thing in a different way, that in retrospect, the degree of attention attached, let's say, in 62 and 63 to the deficit struck me even on arrival, and certainly after being there a while, as if not excessive, certainly rather surprising to me as an academic. But Rosa and Dylan took it seriously. I don't know how well that's weathered, you know, academic scrutiny, but yeah, the situation certainly deteriorated with Vietnam and you know, the changing course of Fed policy and those sorts of things. But
why do you think they took it seriously? Did they think there could be a crisis and people would stop buying dollars and there would be the Bretton Woods system would collapse if it wasn't managed, and you know, foreign central banks would start taking dollars? And
you know, I think the antecedents go back into the late 50s and the behavior of the gold market. And Rosa certainly came down from New York, joining the Kennedy administration, concerned, I guess might be the term, about the financial future of, you know, what was and remains a reserve currency country, and so whether for good or ill, they did take the balance of payment situation as fairly serious. Not immediately, but you know, as sort of a sign that policies needed to be changed to some degree. And of course, they didn't have much that they could do. The carries you into Operation Twist, and as you point out, the interest equalization tax, and then it seems like almost an annual balance of payments program, you know, veering off in as the 60s progressed into a variety of programs, not only conducted at Treasury, probably always at Treasury behest and guidance, but over at Commerce and elsewhere throughout government.
Right. The Fed was had guidelines for bank lending and
Commerce
Department.
Mm-hmm.
Were you involved in the implementation of those programs, or were you more an academic think tank writing memos and
more of that.
The latter.
I knew organizationally I was not in the Office of the Assistant Secretary for International Affairs, or as we called it, OASIA, and functioned more as a staff person for Volcker.
So you were like a personal assistant to Volcker.
Well, I was a visiting academic. I was a consultant and just sort of stayed around. But in the first instance, you know, I wouldn't have been involved in sort of the operational stuff. For example, the interest equalization tax, after initial testimony, you know, pretty much turned over to the lawyers and to a lesser degree to the international people, but it was primarily Office of the General Counsel and, you know, setting a thing up, et cetera.
Early on, you may have been the one who told me this, or maybe Meiselman was the one that told me that Treasury felt it needed to build up its economics department so that it could counter the council, and that didn't turn out to be the case.
Certainly was. Well, Dylan, of course, had been over at State and knew the lay of the land in Washington, and Rosa knew everybody, and I think that probably the two of them decided that Treasury did need to be strengthened in institutionally, you know, vis-a-vis the council and maybe the State Department as well.
But then the sort of the bright young economists that they brought in, I don't know, Dewey Dane and the others, they pretty much left. Was it a lonely place?
Well, Dane came in actually under Julian Baird at the late stages of the Republican administration, and of course stayed. He only left to go over as a governor of the Federal Reserve Board in somewhere along there in the 60s when he and Seymour Harris were the candidates, and Dane was chosen.
Right.
But the crowd that whoever, either David or I, were referring to, Meiselman was pretty early in there, and of course Alan Meltzer,
right.
John Kerrigan, Sam Chase.
Right. Did you have any
variety of reasons that, you know, didn't work out too well?
Did you have any contact with Seymour Harris?
Oh yes, quite a bit. He was, for the Treasury, true consultant. You know, he managed the. We had meetings of, you know, you're familiar with this from the Fed, but we had big academic contingent that would come in and offer advice, solicited and unsolicited, and Seymour Harris ran that operation.
Chairman Martin and Seymour Harris didn't get along. At least Martin distrusted Harris. Do you think that was because of the latter's views on Fed independence, that he didn't think it was desirable?
Well, I don't know. They were just on sort of different wavelengths, weren't they? I mean,
well, sure.
Harris is a
Keynesian
economist, liberal democratic Keynesian, and a very likable guy down from Harvard, and Bill Martin was quite different and impressive in his own way, but. They wouldn't have been congenial on academic issues, although they both were sort of likable personalities in different ways. And I always thought the consultants were, they're very useful to Treasury, certainly. Mm. Probably, well, it'd be in the realm of conjecture, but probably Dillon and Reza thought the idea was a good one from the beginning, and probably resonated over at the White House, and a variety of sort of non-extra economic reasons why it was done. And I look back on it with some nostalgia, and I think it's too bad that it attenuated over the years. And now the Fed has consultants. The Treasury is, so far as I know, Summers occasionally brings some people in.
Volcker left in fall of 65. Wasn't he primarily concerned with domestic debt management before then, or was he concerned with international issues?
No, he would sort of, the debt management, I won't say was a joke, but it's something they do with their left hand, really. It was pretty capable hands, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, civil service, and that's always been fairly strong contingent in Treasury. But just to save time, Volcker did everything, really.
So
domestic and international, sort of shepherded the Troika along under one wing and ran the international stuff on the other. He was a jack of all trades, a master of sort of bureaucratic attention to important issues and inattention to a whole range of others. And,
well, do you have a sense of why he went back to, was it Chase Manhattan?
Probably. He could speak directly to the issue, and I'd only be guessing, but I don't think he was pleased at all by the sort of the general environment. Did remember that Dillon had left. He had a great deal of respect for Fowler, and Fowler had as much or more respect for Volcker, but that's the era of Agnew and, you know, all sorts of problems and troubles down in Washington. I think Volcker just, or am I skipping ahead? I guess I am. He was in and out. him back. He'd been there for, well, quite a few years, and situation was changing, so maybe Chase just made him an offer he couldn't refuse. I don't know.
So who did you work for in those years before Volker came back in 69?
Let's see, what are we talking about? We're talking about the late 60s, aren't we?
66, 67, 68. What about the period?
Wasn't an assistant secretary for economic policy until the turn of administration. Murray Weidenbaum was first, and that must have been a few years later. So I don't know that just what the organization chart would have looked like at the time, but I might have been. I saw a lot of. This would be Fred Deming the Elder, I guess, must have moved in by that time to the undersecretary's job.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked pretty closely with Fowler and with an assistant secretary, passed from memory, Bob Wallace, who was sort of he'd worked for Senator Paul Douglas and was kind of they're sort of in a political assistant secretary, very likable naval guy. He was kind of worked in the economic area to some extent.
Do you have any recollections of March of 1968 when the United States went to the two-tier gold standard, when we stopped buying and selling gold on the private markets? Could that have been August 1971 also, where we closed the gold window? What was the difference between then and the later period when we finally stopped buying gold altogether, selling gold?
I don't have a very strong recollection of the 68 episode. I guess it was probably an important step in the sequence, but I couldn't myself place it with any confidence just offhand. Of course, it was, as you point out, the events a little later when cost push inflation combined with a lot of other things and led up to the events of mid-1971.
Yeah, well, let me ask you about those events and Volker coming back. I was very interested when I read your this paragraph in Changing Fortunes, where you came back with the estimate that the dollar might need to be devalued somewhere between 10% and 15%. That was the first number, and yet that was the number that basically stayed around all through until the Smithsonian Accords, right? So. There were subsequent studies, but apparently those other studies always came pretty much to your number, right? Do you remember?
Yeah, I guess that, you know, probably was sort of a ballpark estimate at the time.
Do you remember any of the sequence of events? Presumably, this was spring of 71 when Volker came to you, and it was clear that the fall in U.S. rates, interest rates, and Europe keeping its rates up was going to turn around the short-term capital flows that had made our balance of payments look good in 69 and 70, and the markets would become nervous. Do you remember any of that sequence of events, and did was there ever a sense of kind of real concern or crisis that something, some disaster might happen? Or?
Well, I suppose in a way it's, I wouldn't want to stretch the parallel too closely, but it reminds me in some ways as comparable to the 62-63 concern over the balance of payments, which, you know, he has many of the same actors there, Rosen no longer, but Volker, and just a belief that, you know, the whatever risks may have been minimal in the early 60s were more substantial in the early 70s. I haven't read or thought, I haven't thought about this in quite a while or even read back some of the fairly decent secondary accounts of those events by now, for all I know, maybe even some books. Wasn't there some suggestion that maybe the Brits wanted to...
Well, this gets...
I think, you know, it's hard to separate the sort of ordered, quasi-analytical stream of events leading up to the events of mid-1971 with, you know, everything that followed, and price control and all sorts of stuff. But I guess we had been, some would say, maybe not with much accuracy, we'd been kind of stuffing dollars into the exchange holdings of a lot of foreign countries, hadn't we?
Mm-hmm.
One way or another, we deemed it essential, and maybe it was, and sort of mixture, it seems to me, of financial economics and diplomacy and God knows what else. And whether or not the situation was truly unstable, it's kind of hard to say. Looking back on it, I think I might feel that the cost-push inflation of the time was somewhat exaggerated, given the clear excesses that occurred by the end of the decade, but it was sort of a dicey situation.
Volcker and Treasury people like Weidenbaum favored price controls as part of the devaluation. Did you have any recollection of that?
I think my recollection is hazy, but yes, I think that's probably accurate.
But then
easily check with Murray, who's likely to be more talkative than Volcker.
Check with whom?
Murray Weidenbaum.
Oh, I will. Yeah, I have not done that, but I will.
Yeah, he's
okay.
He's changed, I doubt if he's a pretty engaging guy, and he probably, I don't know what Volcker would probably cough a few times.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't get much out of Volcker, I don't think. I don't know.
Yeah.
Hard to say.
With the benefit of hindsight, it doesn't seem like this should have been a crisis period. So the dollar was overvalued, but so the model was in spring of 1971, Germany and, I don't know, I guess Holland and a couple other countries floated their currencies, and their currencies were revalued relative to the dollar. So there wasn't a lot the U.S. could do except
always been the case. That's what struck me throughout that episode and even subsequently, that for all practical purposes, I get into value judgments pretty quickly, but I've never thought the only world's reserve currency, a tremendous asymmetry, by and large, to our unquestioned advantage, but I never thought that we had the latitude for effective sort of unilateral reaction, which 71 certainly signified.
But where it became involved with politics was when Connolly put everything together in a package of wage price controls and devaluation with the import surcharge, and then you had a club for forcing other countries speculators in the market knew there were going to be one-way bets that the dollar can only appreciate, so, you know, money flooded into Tokyo, and Germany was floating then, but into Paris, and Connolly then could package this all together as job creation for labor. You had wage and price controls, which were really seen as wage controls for business, and then you had to give something to labor. So what you gave to labor was this job creation that was going to come out of a devaluation of the dollar, and kind of labor per se, like the idea of the import surcharge. And I think that's, if it hadn't been for that combination packaging by Connolly, this closing of the gold window wouldn't have been the dramatic event that it now seems.
Sure. Well, Connolly certainly was an influence, and no shrinking violet by any standard. So the whole program had to get his active support. I'd have to have been hidden in the corner of the room when I wasn't, to be sure, but I don't think it was anything that Connolly forced down anyone's throat.
Mm-hmm. Well, Nixon signed on to it, so that was...
Well, but that's even at a further remove, anyone that had any...
Sure.
...influence. It's certainly true that without Connolly at Treasury, that such a program would not have been carried through. That's right. But I
sure.
Yeah, we'd have to give Connolly some credit for some of the political machinations, but the rest of it was, I think, goes back, well, as I've said, like a broken record, maybe it goes all the way back to Rosa. And
do you have any recollections of the competitions that were going on? At this point, Volcker, of course, was very much in favor of continuing Bretton Woods, but with a significant devaluation of the dollar, 15% or so, that would deal with the balance of payments problems, and he persuaded Connolly to go along with him. But on the other side, you had George Shultz, I guess he was at OMB then, who wanted to move to a floating exchange rate system. And then Connolly was happy to let things go along with the import surcharge, and Kissinger became concerned about the foreign relations aspects of it. And so Burns and Kissinger basically were competing with Connolly for Nixon's attention in terms of, you know, how quickly to settle the situation, and, you know, what size of devaluation to accept. Do you remember any of those details? Or
not very clearly, certainly. You know, the view from the Treasury was that, you know, everyone was pretty much just rushing to catch up with the Treasury, I don't know, bandwagon or steamroller or whatever. I don't think I couldn't throw much light on that.
What about the initial offer that Connolly made and Volcker made in Rome, and I guess it was early December of 71, where they offered to raise the dollar price of gold and kind of meet the French demands at that time? Do you remember that, and whether, you know, how much latitude Connolly had to kind of negotiate a solution?
No, I'm not too clear on that.
Yeah.
Certainly not. No.
Okay. Well, let's go on to the George Shultz Treasury. Shultz had always favored floating exchange rates under Milton Friedman's influence.
Could figure out how that was consistent with the asymmetry noted before. And
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Consistent throughout the post-war period.
Well, that's a good point.
You just let it float, and you have... I never could grasp that scenario too clearly.
Yeah, Well, obviously.
Certainly, you've got a matrix of countries and, yeah. You know, a lot of sense in, but when you have that asymmetry, I never did understand how that would work.
So, well, that's absolutely right, and that's missing from the discussions at the time.
Sure.
People like Friedman, I don't think
analytics, they're very powerful, you know, and who's to say? I certainly wouldn't be amazed that you couldn't. That gets pretty deep. I wouldn't want to pontificate very much more in that area, except that it seems to me that, well, what did Shultz do when he got into Treasury? Maybe we ought to move on. He didn't do anything along those lines, did he?
No, he helped organize a program for moving back toward fixed but movable exchange rates. There was lots and lots of, I don't know, discussion and papers and conferences, but nothing ever came of it. And presumably he was happy with that. I would guess he didn't.
Sure.
But just kind of one way of dealing with the pressures for going back to pegged exchange rates.
Sure.
But yeah.
Yeah. Crawling pegs and wider spreads and a whole bunch of stuff that went back to probably Keynes.
Yeah.
Treatise on money, if not before. You know.
Did you have a change in views about floating versus fixed exchange rates in the 70s? Did your own personal attitudes change? To the Carter administration and Blumenthal. Initially, it wasn't clear who was speaking about the dollar. Who were the people you were working with at that time in the Treasury? And in particular, were you involved with any of the people who were pushing the idea of the locomotive strategy? Because he had been at the Fed, and then he left, and then he came back in the Treasury. So I always feel sort of bad that he died before I could talk to him. I was curious why he would have left the Fed, gone into the.
Been a fount of information. Certainly, as far as Blumenthal was concerned, he and Blumenthal were very close.
So you think Blumenthal relied on Brill for domestic advice?
Considerably. Now, you must understand, I don't mean to see the lecture or anything like that, but
that's the purpose.
The international side of Treasury organizationally would have been very strong through most of this period. Less so in the 70s when Volcker was there, because when he was in Treasury, he ran both the domestic and international sides, and that's pretty much true. But after he leaves, and as we advance into the Carter years, there would have been a lot more influence from the international wing of Treasury. national side of Treasury probably was about as addicted to the locomotive approach, maybe even more so than Brill, who was a pretty hard-headed guy and had a very useful cynical streak running through most anything. But he was certainly, unquestionably, Blumenthal's guy on the domestic economy.
From a point of view of the economists, things come alive in the fall of 78 because inflation begins to rise significantly. There's a big depreciation of the dollar initially. There's a perception in foreign countries that the United States is welcoming the depreciation, but then it goes so far that it becomes a concern diplomatically. So there's a rescue package organized for the dollar in the fall of 78. Would Brill then have been the primary one other than Blumenthal behind
that? I think that's more of the international of tomorrow's laboring. That would have been more of the international side of Treasury. And I just don't know. Brill certainly would have played some role in it, but that, you're much fresher on it than I am, but that at the time seemed significant, and in retrospect even more significant as a sort of a decisive turn, well, a turn for the better, I don't know, but a real turn for the Carter administration.
Yeah, so do you remember any of the names?
I'm probably more than...
Do you remember any of the names?
Embraced.
Yeah. Do you remember any of the names of people on the international side who would have been...
No, my memory is so hazy.
Sure.
No, well, I'm just not sure. Someone like John Petty would go way back, I think, to the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
By the late 70s, it's not entirely clear to me who would have been there. Certainly...
Had Jack Bennett left by then?
Possibly. Bennett was not on the international side. He was the domestic undersecretary.
Okay.
And a very able guy and a tireless advocate of flooding. Appalled by, a whole lot of things that went on inside of Treasury. Always highly regarded within Treasury by anyone that knew him.
Mm-hmm. Was there a feeling that Blumenthal was a capable manager of difficult situations, or was there a feeling that it was probably a good thing when he left?
Opinions differ on that. And so easy to get into personalities, isn't it? Where many times they're just sort of either the victim or the beneficiary of the situation in which they find themselves. Certainly Blumenthal was personally a pleasant guy. I don't know that he was ideally suited for the job, but very few people are.
Mm-hmm.
Not too much he could do. I don't think he had a great deal of influence over across the street at the White House. He may have. How do I know?
Mm-hmm.
Not a very forceful individual, really.
Well, he had strong opinions, but he may not have been
as
a bureaucrat. How about Miller? Was there a clear difference when he came in?
Certainly in terms of personality, and of course Miller has gotten such a bad press, and I imagine memories of him still linger over at the Fed from some of the people. Personally, I thought Miller was much better suited to the disorderly and trying situation than Blumenthal had been. very unusual person. Let me just quickly tell you a little anecdote that something to do with Textron and bribery overseas and just a very untidy
relation
for Miller. And I remember he was a big ornate cash room, and it was the biggest sort of open space in the building, and the reporters practically filled the entire space. And Miller came in without the usual entourage or briefing books or protective shield of functionaries, and he just faced the reporters all down, and I won't say he won. You could hardly win, but I mean, went out with his reputation pretty much intact. Rather unassuming person, but pretty tough. And I don't know, the more I stayed around Washington, the more highly it seemed to me some of those qualities were almost essential for, in some cases, survival in some figurative sense of the term. Mm-hmm. Bud Miller was certainly now probably wouldn't rank him very highly among Treasury secretaries.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess what in a labored way I'm saying, it seemed to me was an improvement over Blumenthal.
But it must have seemed quite an extraordinary change to you to go from the Miller Treasury to the Reagan Treasury under President Reagan, with all the
right.
debates and the sort of fighting over policy, tax cuts, and supply side, and so on. At the time, were you aware of these different groups that were kind of doing the you know, fighting within the Treasury or for, you know, over policy?
In the incoming...
Yeah, in the Reagan administration. Yeah, what were you doing?
Yeah, I got to know these guys pretty well, and...
Weidenbaum came back at that point?
Yeah, but not at Treasury. He was over at the Council, I think, probably as chairman, if I recall correctly. Yeah, I think so, chairman of CEA. And we had some very interesting guys come in. The Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy, Paul Craig Roberts. We've got a deputy, Steve Anton, who's still around town. You could even, if you're interested in this period, you could Anton run something, I forget what it is, Institute for Research in the Economics of Taxation or something. He's very... very capable guy. He's Chicago background. You might want to talk to him. Let's see, we had Craig Roberts and Anton as one deputy, Manuel Johnson another, turned up at the Fed later, didn't he?
Yeah.
And Norman Turay, now deceased, came in as Undersecretary for Taxation. Burl Sprinkle was Undersecretary for Monetary Affairs for a time and then went over to CEA and was chairman. Interesting crowd, beyond question. Yeah.
How do you spell Anton's last name?
A-N-T-I-N.
A-N-T-I-N, okay.
E as in Edward.
Okay.
E-N-T-I-N. Stephen.
Okay.
T-H-J. I probably got it. Before we ring off, I probably got his telephone number up here. Save you some time, maybe. I've got it on a little electronic gizmo.
Okay, good. Sure. I'd like
to. Well, I found that an old guy, and then, of course, Volcker had come back to the Fed in late 79, so he was over there, and we had Don Regan. I don't remember who the deputy was now. That's frequently a non-job. Has been at various times. Hardly when Larry Summers had it.
Yeah.
That was a very, you'll forgive me, but since we're so far off the record, it doesn't matter. I enjoyed, in quotes maybe, I enjoyed that period much more than a decade that had preceded. It's hardly surprising, I suppose, since everything went wrong, in the 70s, from Watergate to the hostages in Iran faculties to the side and kind of enjoyed the whole period, really.
So you think history will be kind to President Reagan, that the country got its self-confidence back, even though it's not the...
I'm not sure about just where Reagan will be placed. You know, it's pretty hard to tell, isn't it? Passage of time, kind of... It certainly was an up decade. How much, you know, was due to... Well, who knows what, when you're talking about these... big shifts and changes, but and sort of the economic thing was rather strange. But even there, well, I don't want to carry into where we need not go. But you know, fiscal affairs had they'd gotten into, you know, probably the part of the form and timing of the tax cuts were ideal, but marginal rates had gotten, you know, pretty absurdly high, and when coupled with the inflation, there was some situations crying out for something to be done, and whether something that was done was ideal, at least something was done. I don't know how much of that was due to the supply side or the Treasury. Probably very little indeed. And probably was more, you know, the disguised monetarism or monetarism and drag or something over at the Fed that really turned the situation around.
I hadn't heard that expression before.
No, well,
it's off the record.